Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Roger McNamee is a former mentor to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. He helped recruit COO Sheryl Sandberg to the company, and then reluctantly became a critic of the way big tech companies like Facebook and Google are abusing their users' trust. Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, is a story that begins with a series of rude awakenings. First, there's the author's dawning realization that the platform is being manipulated by some very bad actors. Then there is the even more unsettling realization that Zuckerberg and Sandberg are unable or unwilling to share his concerns, polite as they may be, to his face. Again, the name of the new book is Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, and it's a pleasure to welcome Roger McNamee to this week's book show. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Joe, it's fantastic to be here in Albany.
Give us a sense of why you wanted to write this story. We talk in the introduction about the realizations.
Yeah.
So the realizations come, and then you say more people should know about this.
So imagine my situation. I began covering the technology industry as an investment analyst in 1982, when the industry was still focused on the space program, right? The space shuttle was still something that was going on. And I got to be there through the whole life cycle of personal computers, the whole life cycle of enterprise technology, then the dawn of the internet, and finally social media. When I met Mark Zuckerberg in 2006, he was 22. Facebook was only 2 years old. It had 9 million in revenues, and it only had high school students and college students on it. They didn't even have a news feed yet. And it happened that Mark had a crisis the day he came to visit, the day I met him. And as it happened, I was able to anticipate what the crisis was. And before he'd said a word, I told him that if it hadn't already happened, I expected that either Yahoo or Microsoft would try to buy his company for $1 billion. And everybody was going to tell him to take it. And my own thought was that Facebook was actually going to be the most important company since Google. And you could see this even though it was brand new. Because Mark in those days had a really firm commitment to the notion that everyone should be themselves. He had authenticated identity because you needed an email address from the school you went to. And he gave you complete control of your privacy. And I was confident that if he kept those two things, his company would be not only game-changing, but just really great and really safe. And that was the context in which our relationship began. And as it happened, the thing that I predicted was the reason he was there. You know, I didn't know. I was just giving him a hypothesis, but it turned out that's what he needed help on. I was able to help him keep the company independent, and that began a 3-year mentorship. And so I felt so warm and cozy about him. I really liked him, and I really liked Sheryl Sandberg, and I introduced the two of them to each other and helped to nurture their relationship so she became the chief operating officer. And it never occurred to me that anything bad would happen there. As an analyst, I really get angry at myself because I missed some signals along the way. And in 2016, at the very beginning of the Democratic primary, I started to see things going wrong inside Facebook that were so out of character for what I thought the product was about that I couldn't help but notice. It shook me out of my sleepiness, if you will. And over the course of that year, I saw enough of them that I reached out to Mark and Sheryl 9 days before the election in 2016 and said, guys, I think there's something wrong with the business model and the algorithms of Facebook that's allowing bad actors to harm innocent people. And I was seeing things in civil rights, and I saw a few things related to the Brexit referendum in the United Kingdom and the Democratic primary. But I wasn't thinking about the U.S. general election at all. And I reached out to them because they were my friends, and I thought they were the victims. Now, as it turned out, they didn't take me seriously, which was sad. But for the 3 months that I attempted to persuade them to embrace the tactics that Johnson & Johnson used after somebody put poison in bottles of Tylenol, which is to say, drop everything, protect the people who use your product. I thought that they could convert a disaster into a giant win in a business where trust was everything, but they treat it like a PR problem. And so I realized I had a role in making this company successful. I profited from it, and I couldn't very well sit back and just watch this disaster unfold and leave it to other people to take care of it. So I became an activist. And in 2017, in meeting with members of Congress, in meeting with people in the press, and lots and lots and lots of citizens, I began to appreciate that I needed a bigger platform than just me. And so in January of 2018, I realized I got to write a book. And that was not something that came easily, but, or that is to say, that decision didn't come easily. The book itself came out almost full grown. In a torrent, literally. I mean, 10 weeks to write the first draft end to end. And that, you know, I'm not a professional writer, but what I had an advantage. I'm a huge Alfred Hitchcock fan. And in this particular story, I'm like the Jimmy Stewart character in Rear Window. I've seen what looks like a crime and I don't understand it. And I'm at the beginning, I'm really an idiot. And part of the fun of the book is you get to see what somebody who's been successful his whole career looks like when they're an idiot. And I tell the story of my discovery and use that to share with you the things you need to know while skipping all the parts you don't need to know. There's no technology in it. There's no gobbledygook. It's about debabilizing a complex set of issues for people because guess what? This affects us all.
Roger McNamee is our guest. The name of the book is Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. October 30th, 2016, as you mentioned, you go and talk to Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg.
I sent them an email.
You sent them an email. You had concerns. You said that they didn't listen to you and they ignored what you were saying. I just want to make clear, do you think they didn't believe you, or worse and more concerning is they knew what was going on?
No, I think they didn't believe me. And here's the thing. People find this hard to believe, but I recognize that we're all entitled to make mistakes, and sometimes the mistakes we make are really huge. When your company is big as Facebook, when you make a mistake, it can affect whole countries. And they have such an intense belief in their mission of connecting the whole world that they believe that justifies any action necessary to get there. So that can create problems. But at the same time, they have this idealism that imagines that no one will ever use the product differently than they would. And as a consequence, they were really blind to what the Russians were doing. They really didn't understand the implications of Stephen Bannon's strategy, which was completely brilliant, of using Facebook to essentially convert a general election into 131 million different general elections, a different one for every voter. And, you know, they were engineers. They went after it. And I think when I first talked to them, they thought that I had sprung a leak. Now, they're also a little bit, shall we say, overconfident. I mean, I'm sure they also looked at me and said, Roger, if you're so smart, where are your 2.2 billion, you know, users? Where are your 40 billion in revenues?
Right.
Right?
When you come to the realization and you start to dig deeper, do you one of the things that you point out in the book, which I think is fascinating, is that this isn't a Facebook problem only. Google, Instagram, Twitter, you refer to them as public health problems.
Yeah.
So how do we go from what happened in the election of 2016 to this of affecting our public health?
So here, the problem with this whole thing, when I talk about being Jimmy Stewart in an Alfred Hitchcock movie, I really mean it.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, too. You could have been that guy.
Possibly. I mean, that I think you're paying me. That's too kind. But there were signals. There are really four aspects of the problem. There is public health. There's democracy. There's privacy, which we now know quite a lot about. And then there's the whole issues of competition and entrepreneurship in the economy. And when I first started this out, the thing I saw first was the threat to democracy and the threat to civil rights, which are both effectively democracy public policy issues. I then met a guy named Tristan Harris, who had been the design ethicist at Google. He was a trained computer scientist with a specialization in persuasive technology. This is the use of computers to basically manipulate people's attention. And he had spoken out about this at Google and attracted some attention in the computer industry, but not so much outside. But he was on 60 Minutes talking about what he called brain hacking. And the idea is, if you're Google or Facebook, You have to get people to come to your site. And the way you do that is you give them rewards that are unexpected, just like a slot machine. And they might take the form of notifications or likes and things like that. And so that gets you to come back, and they want to build a habit. And if the habit gets built, in many people, it turns into an addiction, right? In which it's, you know, we all check our phones at crack of dawn, right? We're all to one degree or another addicted. Right. But that's only half the public health problem. The other half of the public health problem is what you do when you're there. And they basically bombard people with stuff that people have liked in the past and stuff that they would like you to like. And what they call that is a filter bubble. And the notion is that if they show you stuff you like over and over and over again, or stuff you think you might like, you wind up getting more rigid points of view and more extreme points of view. And that drives polarization. But it's worse than that, because you're basically, the most effective ways to do it or to appeal to outrage and fear and to enable people. You know, essentially, there's something about human nature that makes us prefer conspiracy theories and disinformation to facts. MIT has studied this, and it turns out that disinformation spreads 70% further and 6 times faster than facts. And they play to all that because that is what gets you to look at lots and lots of ads. And so what I saw on this was, in democracy, filter bubbles push the country apart. They make compromise impossible because you can't even agree on the facts, right? Normal politics are about, there's a set of facts, and then you disagree about what to do about them. You know, in the world of Facebook and Instagram and Google and YouTube, you know, we can't even agree whether there's climate change or whether there's a link between vaccines and autism.
Right.
And so that level of thing, that's a huge problem. But then you've got the issues related to children. And this is where YouTube Kids and Chromebooks are overstimulating really little children and basically affecting their lifelong ability to pay attention. You have computers in the classroom, which prevent kids from learning to focus on the teacher and learning to socialize with other kids. You have texting and Instagram that allow for bullying, you know, for preteens and teenagers. That's wildly worse than anything that occurred in prior generations. You've got fear of missing out for older teens. And these are all issues leading to long-term public health problems. And we've been through this before. We went through it with tobacco, and we've been through it with other things. And we recognize, as a society, there are some business prerogatives that you have to take away because, you know, they conflict with the interests of the society as a whole. And this will be one of them.
Roger McNamee is our guest. The name of the book is Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. The catastrophe in your subtitle, is that what happened to the company or what's happening to us?
It's what's happening to us. And I use the word very carefully because what I talk about in the book is just the beginning. I very explicitly make the point that the story doesn't end when I get done with the book. What the book is designed to do is to prepare you for a world where the issues I raise in the book are persistently in our environment. So here's what's happened. You know, the early Google was a search engine. They received lots of data from the users, which they used to improve the search engine, but they got all sorts of data that had nothing to do with improving the search engine, but they discovered it had predictive power for the behavior of the people who are using the search engine. So they crafted a whole idea of, we're going to gather a lot of data, and instead of just selling advertising, we're going to sell predictions about human behavior. And they began that in 2003. So when Facebook comes along, Google's already several years into this idea. And Facebook follows it very aggressively. And the notion at the beginning is, we're going to gather all this data, and we're going to use filter bubbles and recommendation engines to increase the probability that the predictions we make come true. So when you're going in, you see this recommendation engine that says, hey, if you like this thing, you're going to like that thing. I mean, maybe that's true. But what I know for sure is the guy who owns the recommendation engine wants you to like the thing that they're recommending.
Right.
And so think of that as phase two. Let me tell you where it ends. And this is why it gets so scary. These guys are not just gathering data on you from what you do inside their website. They're following you everywhere you go on the web. So no matter what you do, they're tracking you. But they're also buying your credit card transaction data from credit card processors. They're buying financial data from other sources as well. They're buying your location data from your cell phone carrier. They're buying health data from health and wellness applications where it's available. And they're buying data wherever they can get it. You know, Google goes around and has Street View and takes pictures of your neighborhood. And, you know, they have Google Earth and they're taking pictures of your house from above. And they've basically declared that they own all this data that is either your private data or data that used to be shared by all of us. And they've decided they own it. And they're using it along with machine learning and artificial intelligence to then nudge you in directions that are economically valuable. What comes next is they're tracking everything about you. So, for example, all of these guys track your mouse movement. Sometimes you may sign up for a website and you see that Google thing called CAPTCHA where they show you photographs and they say, touch on the ones with a car.
I always get it wrong.
Okay, or touch the ones with a street sign.
Yeah.
Do you know what's going on there?
Well, they're trying to keep out the robots, right?
No. What's really going on is you're training the artificial intelligence for Google's self-driving car. They figured out that you are a human being based on your mouse movement. And since they already have your identity, they track your mouse movement over time. So that means that if, God forbid, you ever develop a neurological disease like Parkinson's, it will show up in your mouse movement very early in the symptom period, probably before you're even aware that you have it. So they will know that you're going to be really sick before you know it. Now, you'd like to think that they would call you up right away and say, go to your doctor, get this checked out. But the way the economics work today, you're not their customer. You're the fuel for their business. And they might well choose to sell to the highest bidder, who might well be your insurance company or an insurance company that wants to raise rates or take away your coverage. And I'm sitting there, the reason I'm doing this, the reason I became an activist against companies I was involved in and that I love dearly, is that I just think that's un-American.
Roger McNamee is our guest. The name of the book is Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. One of the things that I think is a problem here is that so many of us think that we're already, the information's already out there.
Right.
They already know all of this stuff about us. So why should I worry about it now if everything I do is being monitored? So how do you clamp down and get people not to give everything over?
Joe, I think you want to go after a different part of the food chain.
Okay.
So, yes, it is demonstrably true, Joe, that your data's out there, my data's out there. What we can control, though, is what happens with it.
Okay.
So what I want to do is I'm asking a set of questions because we have an election coming in 2020. And the questions I want to ask are, why is it legal to have commerce in your personal financial transactions? Why should anybody be able to trade or sell your credit card history? Why should anybody be able to do the same thing with your other financial records? Why should any cellular carrier be able to sell your location data? In fact, why should anybody on the web be able to sell your location data? Why should anybody be able to track you? Why should they be able to acquire health data from a wellness application? Why should they even be able to hold data, much less trade it, on children? These are things that they have grabbed because we didn't realize that was what was going on. They were very sneaky about it. Google started it, then Facebook followed. Now Amazon and Microsoft will do some of the same things. And my point is, in election cycle, I think we can sit there and say, I'm sorry, this is not up to us to change our behavior. We want to stop these guys because they're the ones who are at fault. That they're creating the equivalent of toxic chemical spills, and they're not having to pay the cost of it. Now, California's got a new bill that's going to allow us to sue anybody for damages. But that's not enough. We have to prevent the use and trading of our private data. And I think this is one of those things that, you know, so many issues in America are right versus left. This one is right versus wrong. And I am working with people in Washington on both sides of the aisle. And everybody pretty much gets it. When you describe the thing with the mouse movement and the possibility of getting a neurological disease and the possibility that they do not have a legal obligation to both protect that information and tell you first, everybody understands that's wrong, that that's just not the American way of doing things.
When it comes to the next step for Facebook, how bad are things for them?
Well, That's a great question. Right now, things are actually not bad. You know, their fourth quarter, which they reported in January, was a record, and it was up like 60%. Now, there are a bunch of factors in that. Facebook still has the best platform for advertisers that exists in the world. And the December quarter, that is the peak retail quarter, so you expect that. You may have also noticed in your newsfeed, as I noticed in mine, that now every fifth or sixth post is an ad. And that number is about twice what it was a year ago.
Right.
And they can't keep doubling the rate that they put ads in because pretty soon it's classified, right? And, you know, once it's classified, you're not seeing any of your friends. And so that's going to end the game. I think Facebook has a huge problem on the mothership of Facebook. I think right now it's basically been able to skate on the huge issues associated with Instagram. And, you know, Facebook should be a fine business without hurting anybody. Google should be a fine business without hurting anybody. YouTube, it's harder to tell. YouTube hurting people is basic. That is Google's, that is YouTube's business. But, and what I mean by that is that YouTube is so full of disinformation. It's so full of conspiracy theories and hateful stuff. I mean, recruiting for terrorists, training for terrorists, complete misinformation that on health and other things that I'm not sure that can be salvaged. But what's so weird is that individually we love these products. They're convenient. They're fun. But for society, they're incredibly dangerous. And even for us, they're dangerous in ways that we need to become aware of. And we have political power, and our elected representatives know they have to do something. But these companies are spending a lot of money on lobbying. And, you know, we need to make our voice heard.
In making our voice heard, are we still going to be able to do the cool things that social media allowed us to do?
Joe, great question. So the answer is, of course, we should be allowed to and should be able to. What I want to do is I want to use antitrust law to create some space for a new generation. These guys have largely ended innovation by startups anywhere near where their core businesses are. And we're going to need to use antitrust law to clear some space for things. The Silicon Valley that I spent most of my career in was one that was dominated by the philosophy of making the world better. Part of the reason these guys got away with so much harm is that we trust tech, and we had really good reason to trust tech for 50 years. And, you know, it was really embodied in this vision that Steve Jobs used to talk about, where he would talk about computers as bicycles for the mind. You know, they made us more efficient, more productive. I want to get back to that. There is a version of every one of these services that we love that will be profitable and completely benign. And I would like to think that Google and Facebook and the others would get back to that, but I don't want to take any chances. I want to clear space so that competitors can get started and be protected from attack by these guys. And I'm getting a hearing on that. I mean, when I go to Washington, I meet with the Department of Justice, I meet with the Federal Trade Commission. They want to learn, they want to understand, and they are making moves. And it's still early days, and these things take a while, but Congress is learning rapidly. You know, they didn't know until 18 months ago that there was anything to look at here. And tech is way less complicated than things they regulate well today, like banking and healthcare. So I'm very confident we'll get there. I'm really optimistic because there's so many more of us than there are of them that I think we're going to get there.
Roger McNamee is the author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. The book is published by Penguin Press. Thank you very much for being with us, Roger.
Great Joe, it's been a great pleasure. I want to thank WAMC, and I especially want to thank all the people who bought the book and put it on the New York Times bestseller list, because my mother and father are looking down from heaven and smiling, because I can only imagine how much that would have excited them.
Good stuff. Again, Roger McNamee's new book is Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. It is published by Penguin Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.